Over on Patreon, my beloved supporters vote each month on a topic that I should cover here on SideQuest, and today's show revolves around just such a topic. The original winner of the vote was my favorite JRPGs of all time, but as I'm known to do every now and then, I'm going to morph the topic into something a little different. Instead of JRPGs, I'm going to include all role-playing games, and instead of widening the focus to all-time games, I'm narrowing the focus to include games released only in the last decade. This is just my list, of course, a list of 10 games, 8 I've beaten and 2 I've played extensively but not beaten, that I'd recommend out of the genre. Everything is subjective, of course, and I think my list would change on any given day I wrote the script, but nonetheless, here are my 10 favorite role-playing games of the last decade, games I hope you also enjoy, or if you've not played them yet, games I hope that you get to try out for yourself. First up on the list is Bloodborne, the acclaimed PlayStation 4 exclusive launched back in early 2015. Bloodborne was a substantial game, not only literally, but in terms of what it represented, too. Remember, developer From Software started the whole Souls movement back in 2009 with the PS3 exclusive Demon's Souls, which Sony published in Japan, but relinquished in the West. This allowed Demon's Souls sequels, the Dark Souls games, to go multi-platform. Bloodborne was a subtle nod to that, with Sony making a sizable investment in a beautiful, difficult AAA Souls game just for PS4, and the players went wild for it. A Souls game with a twist, Bloodborne was just a tad faster than what came before it, a tad more playable, while still retaining the essence of what it was really all about. Grueling, punishing gameplay, abstract, fascinating lore, and, in the case of Bloodborne, a world that looked like it was pulled straight out of Castlevania. That's the reason why I paid attention to this game in the first place. Bloodborne is one of two games on this list I never beat, though. I played it when it came out, got distracted, and then picked it back up towards the second half of 2017, when I quickly became enamored with it. I must have played it for at least 50 hours, meticulously moving through the game, though not always with the greatest of skill, to the point where even my girlfriend, who was accustomed to seeing me play all manner of game, started to observe my fascination. Unfortunately, I got sidetracked by something else by the time I got near the end of the campaign, and when I returned, I had lost much of my gameplay skill. Alas, that's how it goes, but the game, at least how I experienced it, has stuck with me, and it's one of those adventures I absolutely must get back to when time allows. Next up is Fallout New Vegas, the beloved Fallout game developed by Obsidian Entertainment and released in the fall of 2010. Fallout, of course, is an IP controlled by publisher Bethesda, and their flagship Bethesda Game Studios made both 2008's Fallout 3 and 2015's Fallout 4. But in between those two titles was New Vegas, an externally molded open-world RPG that many Fallout fans consider to be better than both Fallout 3 and 4. At least I do, and I know lots of people are with me. Here's what New Vegas had that Fallouts 3 and 4 didn't. Gray. Lots and lots of gray. And I don't mean that in terms of the aesthetic either. Rather, I mean that New Vegas' story was gray, a post-apocalyptic tale in what was once Nevada, where your choices aren't so binary, and where you sometimes think you're doing one thing, only to find out you're actually doing something else. Compared to the black and white nature of Fallout 3 in particular, New Vegas felt so fresh and so new, and it's still such a memorable experience nearly a decade later. Of course, to play New Vegas, you have to accept the infamous Bethesda jank that comes along with it, because even if Bethesda didn't develop it themselves, they did publish it, and Obsidian used their engine and their tools to make the game a reality. But once you get past its archaic look and feel, what you'll find is a wonderful world worthy of exploration, a dynamic story with a ton of moving parts, and rewarding quest, loot, and leveling systems that provide multiple hooks to gamers looking to sink scores of hours into a single campaign. New Vegas holds such a special place with so many gamers that people around the world had once hoped that Obsidian would return to Fallout one day. Now that the studio has been acquired by Microsoft and is an Xbox-exclusive team, however, the likelihood of that ever happening has fallen to precisely zero. Horizon Zero Dawn is one of my very favorite games on PlayStation 4, and it's next up on my list of 10 awesome RPGs from the last decade. Launched in early 2017 and developed by the Sony-owned Dutch studio Guerrilla, Horizon was a bit of a foray into the unknown for the team that made it. Remember, Guerrilla Games was once known only for Killzone, a first-person shooter series, and so that it was able to segue so seamlessly and so expertly to an open-world third-person action RPG speaks a great deal to their talent. That's no easy feat. In fact, it represents a gigantic risk for a studio that could be relied upon to make one thing pretty well. With Horizon, though, we now know Guerrilla can make another thing even better. And that's really awesome to see. While I hope that doesn't eliminate a future for Killzone, it's always great to see a studio try new things, and be rewarded both critically and commercially for doing so. Horizon takes place in a far-flung future, nearly 1,000 years from now, in fact, and stars a red-headed female protagonist named Aloy. Aloy is a hunter of nearly unimaginable skill, and in her world, those skills come in handy because the landscape is barely marked by humanity and has rather been overtaken by mysterious mechanical beasts of unknown provenance. Horizon's world is gorgeous, its story is riveting, its quest structure is satisfying, and its gameplay is completely sublime. It's the latter that really makes Horizon stand out in a sea of open-world RPGs that can be found all over the shelves at your local GameStop. Yes, Horizon is a masterclass of design on all possible fronts, but it's also so incredibly fun to play, and I can't wait to sink my teeth into the inevitable sequel, possibly, if not likely, on PS5. At the top of this video, I noted that CLS's patrons originally wanted this list to be all about JRPGs. While I changed it up a bit for my video, it's time we finally talk about a JRPG. I am Setsuna. This game's inclusion may surprise some people. It wasn't a critical darling nor a commercial hit, but it resonated with me in such a deep, meaningful, and lasting way that I'd be totally remiss not including it here on my list. I Am Setsuna is an emotional roller coaster, a deeply traditional turn-based JRPG all about sadness. Really, that's the theme. But beyond that, I Am Setsuna was made with an idea in mind, to recapture the glory days of the 16-bit and 32-bit JRPG. As the first game out of Tokyo RPG Factory, a Japanese studio owned by Square Enix, I think I Am Setsuna hit the mark wonderfully, and while others disagree, it's a game I continue to recommend highly to JRPG fans looking for something new, yet old. The beauty of I Am Setsuna is in its familiarity, and it's that familiarity that compounds the game's inherent sadness, sadness heightened even more by an amazing piano-centric soundtrack that tugs at the heartstrings. Its look and feel are also familiar. Turn-based combat is packed by menus to delve into, story is told through lots of text without the aid of voice acting, and its linearity is only slightly perturbed by a series of character-centric side quests that add texture to the entire experience. Tokyo RPG Factory's newest game, Lost Sphere, showed that I Am Setsuna may have been nothing more than lightning in a bottle, as Lost Sphere isn't a tenth as good. But that doesn't detract from what I Am Setsuna does so successfully, which is to recapture the glory days of a genre that's seen so much tumultuous change, and to deliver something to old-school gamers that's most akin to a warm blanket and a cup of tea. I'm bending the rules even more than I already have with my next selection, and I'm bending said rules in two ways. By selecting the Mass Effect trilogy as a whole, I'm not only shoehorning three games into one here, but I'm also selecting one game, the original Mass Effect, that falls slightly out of the decade-long window I've put forth here. Launched in 2007, with its sequels coming in 2010 and 2012, Mass Effect's three games had so much that I love. A space setting, non-linear choice-based play, third-person shooting, and a heaping helping of alien sex. When you really think about it, what EA-owned studio BioWare managed to accomplish with Mass Effect is nothing short of staggering. These three games actually talk to one another. Choices made in one affect another, and so on. It's the very definition of ambitious design, and frankly, you still don't see studios doing stuff like this, especially when it comes to all-important player agency. For many players, Mass Effect 2 is the pinnacle of the series, though I've always been partial to the third installment, which I feel many players were, and still are, far too hard on. But I think we can all agree that the original Mass Effect had by far the truest RPG feel, and I kinda wish they stuck with that more as they moved forward. By making the series accessible to a wider audience, though, BioWare created a phenomenon during the PS3 and Xbox 360 era, which made the launch of Mass Effect Andromeda in 2017, largely considered a complete disaster compared to the original trilogy, all the more disappointing. But Mass Effect is still alive, well, and a ton of fun in the original trilogy, so if you're looking for a palate cleanser following Andromeda, rest assured that not everything Mass Effect has been lost. What do you get when you combine the game design know-how of Japanese Studio Level 5 with the world-famous art of Studio Ghibli? You get Ni no Kuni: Wrath of the White Witch, a JRPG launched exclusively on PlayStation 3 in 2011 in Japan and in early 2013 in the West. A major riff on a Nintendo DS game launched a couple of years prior, Wrath of the White Witch was a bit of a Western phenomenon, one that took publisher Namco Bandai by surprise. Used to releasing Tales games once a year or so to a specific audience, Ni no Kuni flexed far beyond that user base, ultimately selling more than a million copies in Western markets, a major success for a game of its kind. And what kind of game is Ni no Kuni exactly? It's kinda like Pokemon, actually. You fight enemies, collect them to do your bidding, and go through a beautifully illustrated adventure with those creatures as your proxy. But the reality is that Ni no Kuni: Wrath of the White Witch is a far deeper and more robust affair than any single Pokemon game, because battling with familiar-type foes just scratches the surface. It's the game's story, its emotional, heart-wrenching tale, that truly rests at the very center of what Ni no Kuni is all about. A plot surrounding a young boy, the loss of his mother, and his want to find comfort and solace in an unpredictable, lonely existence. Doing so brings protagonist Oliver from the real world to a fictional land full of mystery, intrigue, and beautiful illustrations. Perhaps it's Studio Ghibli's art that really puts it over the top, but Ni no Kuni is one of the most emotional, tear-jerking RPGs you'll ever rest eyes upon, and it's accessible enough that even those that traditionally don't like JRPGs could still find something to enjoy. Ni no Kuni: Wrath of the White Witch is very easily one of PlayStation 3's most special and unique games. Believe it or not, there was a time when I was a huge Pokemon fan, spanning all the way back to the late 90s, when I'd sit across the table from my good friend with linked Game Boys playing Pokemon Red and Blue with reckless abandon. Fast forward about two decades, and my love for the franchise has dropped precipitously, but I had one awesome final go with the series with Pokemon Heart Gold and Soul Silver back in the early part of 2010. You may remember the original Pokemon Gold and Silver as the first true sequels to Red and Blue, launched back in 1999 on Game Boy Color. Heart Gold and Soul Silver are Nintendo DS remakes of those classic games, and playing through Soul Silver in particular was a ton of fun for me, a way to relive those high school years one more time in a wonderfully updated format. Nostalgia helped fuel my love of these games, sure, but in reality, Heart Gold and Soul Silver are glorious titles that reach back to the past, but bring the conventions of Pokemon very much to what was at the time the present. For many players, these games, both in their original formats and in this updated form, represent the very height of Pokemon, and I can't say I disagree. I think what I've always loved about these games the most, though, is how casually or obsessively you can play them, and how both styles, or some hybrid of the two, can provide any given player with a truly astounding experience. In my younger days, I really would catch them all, leveling them all up evenly, obsessing over every detail. As I got older, though, I played a little differently, a little looser, a little more conscious of time, and I loved it then, too. As Pokemon continues to thrive on both mobile and Switch, it's sometimes good to go back and get a taste of what once was, and Heart Gold and Soul Silver are a perfect way to do just that. Out of all of the games on this list, South Park: The Stick of Truth, which launched in 2014, had the most unusual, uneven, and perhaps even tortured development, but it's also one of the strongest of these 10 games. See, The Stick of Truth was caught between a rock and a hard place. It was developed by Obsidian Entertainment, a team that also appeared on this list via Fallout New Vegas, but it was originally supposed to be published by THQ. Then THQ went belly up, and the rights to the game were suddenly up in the air. It was unclear who, if anyone, would claim it, and whether the game would be finished at all. Then something unusual happened. Ubisoft stepped up to the plate, acquired the rights to the game, funded it being finished, and even extended its development cycle by a full year. The results speak for themselves, because South Park: The Stick of Truth is absolutely, positively glorious. Now, at the time the game came out, I wasn't much of a South Park fan anymore. After hearing how awesome the game was, though, I played it, and I platinumed it. Playing and platinuming the game in turn got me to watch the show again. Very, very few games are laugh out loud funny ever, not to mention constantly. That, I think, is what makes Stick of Truth truly notable. Of course, it's a blast to play too, and it's a ton of fun to exist in the world of South Park, with so many familiar characters, locales, and more. Its RPG systems are accessible, and really are a means to an end so you can simply see what the boys say and do next. I absolutely adore this game, as well as its sequel, 2017's South Park: The Fractured But Whole. But I have to give a nod to one game over the other, and so I'll go with the original, a game worthy of play even if you're not a South Park fan. Playing The Stick of Truth may just change your mind. As we near the end of my list, I'd be loath not to give a mighty tip of the cap to Tactics Ogre: Let Us Cling Together, a turn-based strategy RPG first launched only in Japan in the 90s, while finally seeing a Western release on PSP in 2011. It was obviously that Western port that provided my first experience with what is one of the very great strategy RPGs of all time, second perhaps only to Final Fantasy Tactics, a game that very much resembles Tactics Ogre in virtually every way. I suppose Let Us Cling Together's inclusion on this list is more of a eulogy, though, because for some strange reason, no one is making games like this anymore. You'd think we'd get a Final Fantasy Tactics or Tactics Ogre from Square Enix every couple of years or so, but you'd be wrong. Both franchises are sadly dormant and have been for some time. Now, a lot of people will exclaim that we are getting games like this. Disgaea and Valkyria Chronicles are two such examples of similar series. But those familiar with Tactics Ogre and the Final Fantasy Tactics franchises know full well that they're actually quite different. They feel different, they play different, and they have that special something in comparison. The serious lore, customization, and combat depth of those games simply aren't matched in any way by contemporary games, and their old-school graphical flair certainly has something to do with those aforementioned franchises not feeling quite the same in comparison. For me, Tactics Ogre: Let Us Cling Together was an amazing swan song for PSP. The Vita was directly on the horizon when it came out, and I still remember obsessing over it for months as I awaited Sony's new handheld. Giving it a nod here is the very least I can do, and we can keep our fingers crossed that hereafter Square Enix finally wises up and gives us more. The final game on the list is the second game I've put into this video that I didn't beat but played extensively, The Witcher 3: Wild Hunt. The Witcher 3 came out in the spring of 2015, and although it was the third game in CD Projekt Red's Witcher series, a series based on Polish fantasy novels, it was The Witcher 3 that truly catapulted not only The Witcher itself, but its developer into the limelight. The fact is, no one knew that Poland's very own CD Projekt Red was capable of a game like this, a game widely considered to be a benchmark in open-world RPGs, a game that frankly makes newer experiences from the likes of Bethesda look meager by comparison. At the beginning of the video, I talked about Bloodborne and how I played it forever and got distracted. Something a little different happened with The Witcher. I felt like there was almost too much game, and I felt satisfied that I saw everything I wanted to see at the time. But in reality, walking away after such a deep, roughly 50-hour commitment was a mistake. In actuality, this game stuck with me after I stopped playing it, and I constantly bring it up as an adventure that should be shamelessly mimicked in all it does right. It's grown on me significantly over time, and since I never experienced the DLC, it's high on my list of something to return to in full when there's a lull in both my work schedule and the launch calendar. But in the meantime, I'll never forget literally hauling my PS4 from California to Atlanta, where I had to be on business, just so I can sit in my hotel room for days on end to play it. It was that good, and a fitting end to a video that celebrates such a wonderful genre.